From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cindy Canty. On today's show, the state legislature begins a new session. Education funding and reforms will be front and center.
The problem we have today is some of the reforms that are necessary in the schools so that we have more competitive marketplace in the schools.
And Michigan's police departments are shrinking.
And it's frustrating, you know, knowing that we can do a better job, that we can protect our citizenry better if we had more resources that are available.
And with Detroit's top lawyer now gone, could the city finally move forward?
Privately, they thought the biggest impediment to moving ahead with restructuring the city was not the city council or the mayor, it was the lawyer.
We'll have those stories and much, much more on today's Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cindy Canty. Detroit Mayor Dave Bing says a review team could make recommendations to Governor Snyder as early as this week on whether a takeover of the city's finances by an emergency manager should happen. We'll have that story on today's show. And in 2001, local police agencies had more than 22,000 police officers. Today, that number has dropped by 16% to just under 19,000. We'll find out what that really means for cities across the state. But before we get to those stories, the 97th session of the Michigan legislature began today at the state capitol. The formality of swearing in new lawmakers, choosing leaders, and picking seats played out as protesters picketed outside. In a few minutes, we'll talk about what we can expect to happen this legislative year in Lansing and how all of the politics will play out. But first, Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta tells us what it was like today at the Capitol.
First thing this morning, a few hundred protesters, union members, activists surrounded the Capitol to greet lawmakers as they walked in. Democrats got cheers. The demonstrators also hoisted big pictures of every Republican who voted for a right-to-work law during last year's lame duck session. Here's what happened when Representative Bruce Rendon, one of those Republicans, walked by.
Shame! It's their walk of shame.
Lyle Birchman is an auto worker for General Motors here in Lansing.
I'm here for working families. I'm very concerned about the future. The line of nonsense that the Republicans are peddling is not true. The things that they did last year are just plain wrong.
Birchman says the fact that GM opened two new car plants in the Lansing area before Michigan became a right-to-work state shows the law was not necessary and just created tensions and hard feelings. By noon, the action had pretty much moved. Inside the Capitol, lawmakers went through the formalities of opening day. One of those was re-electing Republican Jace Bolger as Speaker of the House. 2 years ago, Bolger used his opening day address to call for a discussion on making Michigan a right-to-work state. This year, Bolger called for fewer regulations, better schools, more access to preschool, making it easier for families to adopt children, and coming up with a better way to pay for roads. Bolger also said it's time to set aside any lingering bitterness from last year.
Throughout all of the work awaiting us this session, we should seek to build and rebuild relationships. This past year has strained relationships. However, we can and should leave that past behind us.
House Democratic leader Tim Grimmel seconded Bolger's nomination as Speaker, but said that does not mean his caucus will ignore what happened last year.
Today is the first opportunity to move forward and to do what this legislature owes it to the people of the state of Michigan to do, and that's to do better than it did last term.
There was some concern among Republicans that Democrats would break with the traditional display of unity on opening day by denying Bolger a unanimous or at least unopposed vote for Speaker. And two Democrats, Representatives Doug Geis and Diane Slavens, could not bring themselves to vote for their nemesis. And so when the time came, they pushed the red buttons on their desks. For Stateside, I'm Rick Pluta at the state capitol.
Well, let's talk now about the politics of the new session with two big political players joining us now. Saul Anousis, former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, and Debbie Dingell, president of D2 Strategies and a Democratic National Committee woman. Saul, Debbie, welcome.
Great to be with you. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. And I want to start where Rick Pluta just left off in that report. The new Democratic minority leader in the state house, Tim Grimmel, he's saying that his caucus, the Democrats, are not going to forget what Republicans did during the lame duck, passing controversial measures like right to work, like the new emergency manager law. Debbie, I want to start with you. It sounds like the air is not cleared yet over right to work.
I would say that's definitive, that the air is not cleared and I believe will be an issue for the next 2 years. The challenge for Democrats is to develop a strategy that gets at the core of the issue and unites people but doesn't hurt Michigan in the process.
I think Debbie's right. I think this will be continue to be an issue, but the most important part of what she said was how do we move forward and not hurt Michigan? So I think both sides will have to make their political points. Both sides will want to make sure that their constituencies realize they're still fighting for the things that they believe in. But the most important part of this and the biggest challenge for all of us is how do we do what's right and what's best for Michigan? How do we move forward on good public policy where we actually have common ground? So that's always the political balance that our legislative leaders have to come up with, where people like Debbie and I who can fight politically have to come up with, but then say, where do we step back and then move together where it's important for the good of the state and the good of the people in the state of Michigan?
Well, let's talk about that looking forward. You know, some of the items on the legislative agenda, transportation funding, education reforms. I mean, those are big issues. Are those issues that Democrats and Republicans are going to be able to work together?
Well, education is going to be another very, very tough issue. And the direction in which we go, there are real philosophical differences. I'm very concerned that Michigan is slipping nationally competitively at all levels, and we cannot allow that to continue to happen. We need to put an emphasis on everything from 0 to 5 through higher education and how that gets funded, how we make sure we have good teachers. There are just a number of very controversial issues. I think many on the Democratic side believe it's important to support the public education system. Others raise the question, and to make sure that we have good teachers and how do you build an accountability for them. I am very concerned about what the direction is on education and how we can make sure that we are funding our schools to be competitive. We're giving our children the best education, because if you're a parent, if I have an option of a charter school, a public school, I want my child to get educated at the best school. So our challenge is to make sure that every child has the opportunity to go to a school that provides them the best education.
Yeah, so we saw some of these education reform proposals sort of peek their head out during lame duck. They weren't passed, though. Are you seeing that coming back? And will Republicans work with Democrats over education reform?
Well, I think they will. I mean, I think that there is a philosophical difference. This is where probably Debbie and I disagree with, you know, from a practical standpoint. I mean, funding is not the problem in Michigan right now. We have one of the highest rates of funding per pupil in the country. And we have some of the best paid teachers in the country. The problem we have today is some of the reforms that are necessary in the schools so that we have more competitive marketplace in the schools. So these charter schools have a chance to flourish so that specialty schools that are, whether they're dealing with minority children, with all males of people who don't have heads of households or fathers in the households, et cetera. There are lots of different things that we have to address that culturally affect how our children are educated and whether they get a good education or not. I mean, it's somewhat ironic that, you know, the last couple governors, whether it was Governor Granholm, Governor Engler before him, all who had small children sent their kids to, you know, charter schools or Montessori schools because the school system wasn't working. And these schools were funded half the cost of the public school system. So we do need fundamental reforms in education. We do have to make sure education is a key priority. But I think that, you know, you can also take a look at some of the studies where several years back there was a study that showed 68% of the kids who graduated from Michigan colleges and universities, arguably some of the best in the country, couldn't find a job in Michigan and were moving outside the state to get a job. So there's a brain drain there even when we bring our kids through there. So we've got to turn Michigan's economy around. We've got to turn our cultural state around so that people are staying and living in the state of Michigan. And probably the most important thing we can do to get there is education. The question is, How do we do that?
And that's what I want to get to is, I mean, it sounds like everyone's sort of agreeing that there need to be some changes. You know, it's obviously there are differences in how those changes are made. But is there an actual willingness right now for Democrats to work with Republicans? I mean, are they going to just be dragging their feet going, we didn't get what we wanted last year. Why should we give you what you want now?
I don't think that that's going to be the discussion. I think it's going to be a very policy-directed discussion about which direction we should go. And I think one of the things that has happened in the last year in particular, and an issue that happened with right to work, is the demonization of teachers. Mm. The MEA and the AFT, Michigan Federation of Teachers, know that they need to address the issue of a teacher is not performing. But overwhelmingly, the teachers in this state are teaching because they want to help children and they want to educate our children. And demonizing our teachers does not get any of us any place. We need to have, and I think Democrats very much want to come to the table and talk about the direction of education policy in this state. The demonization, which has been very much a part of the dialogue for the last year, is not a healthy dialogue and accomplishes nothing.
Well, so Debbie, I guess my next question is for you also then. You know, I'm wondering what we're going to see from the Democratic Party. It's hard to talk, of course, about them as a whole, but from Democrats in this new session, like I said, Representative Grimel saying he's ready to lead his caucus aggressively. Do you think we're going to see Democrats pushing more of an agenda, going sort of from defense to offense?
I think you're going to see both. I think clearly when you're in a minority, your ability to drive the legislative agenda is more limited. But I think at both a national and a state level, you're going to see Democrats trying to drive a policy agenda that is what is the best for this state. And, you know, the state is doing better. But the fact of the matter is the state is doing better because of things that happened 4 years ago. I don't think it does as well to demonize or to say Republicans did this, Democrats didn't, Democrats did this, Republicans don't. Many of the things that have contributed to our economy recovering quicker than some of the other states are because of things like the Obama administration helping the domestic auto industry. I think we all need to celebrate our success at the beginning of recovery and work together to try to ensure that the economic recovery of this state continues, that we do attract jobs. There will be a disagreement on how we best attract those jobs. We need to do it in a healthy environment climate that keeps us moving forward, not backwards.
Speaking with Debbie Dingell and Saul Anuzis here on Stateside. We'll take a quick break and continue with Saul and Debbie. We'll also get the latest on Detroit's finances. Is a state-appointed emergency manager looking more and more possible for the city? That story in 15 minutes. This is Stateside here on Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in today for Cindy Canty. We're speaking with Debbie Dingell, Democratic National Committee woman and president of D2 Strategies, as well as Saul Anuzis, former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. And I want to pick up on this sense of willingness or the willing to sort of work together. And I'm wondering about how the new freshmen who were sworn in today will fit into all of this. More than two dozen new House members. How is this going to help maybe possibly bipartisanship in Lansing?
I think it's very important, and I hope that that does happen. Saul and I are good friends. We disagree violently over the direction sometimes of issues, but we always talk. I think there is a lot of anger over what happened at the end of the last lame duck. I think you will see very intense passion and emotion about the election for 214 and electing people that will represent the direction that people believe that the policy should go on. But I also think it's very important for people to work together and have healthy and constructive dialogue in a way that is not damaging to the future of this state or this country.
Saul, what do you think? Do you think these two dozen plus new House members will change the dynamic of things in Lansing?
Well, yeah, I think they'll clearly change the dynamic. And the issue is that it will take some time to build relationships. And, you know, I was a big supporter early on of term limits. And I thought that, you know, it served a role at the time. But, you know, I have to tell you today, I almost wish that, you know, I would rather go for a part-time legislature and get rid of term limits, because those relationships do matter. You know, Debbie pointed out the fact that she and I are good friends. I mean, look, we can disagree on certain issues, but we can also say, look, we've got to set these two things aside. We have another battle that's more important to fight for the good of the state or the good of the country. And that only happens when you have a relationship with people, when there's a degree of trust and understanding where you can look at one another and say, we can't put these issues aside, and we know we're going to come back and fight them another day, but we're going to do what's in the best interest. And this is sometimes where the fear of, you know, brand new numbers coming in, they all have their own agendas, which is great. We want to have real citizens, people who live in the real world representing us and coming in. And, you know, originally we thought that term limits were the way to do that. And over the years and watching the legislature move, I have to say that I've evolved from being a term limit guy to more being a part-time legislative guy, where I think that, you know, we'd be better off having people with institutional knowledge and the relationships to move us forward and maybe coming back down to a part-time legislature rather than having term limits and people who come in and sometimes leave before they make, you know, very many friends or can really have an influence on the process. So that, I think, is also a debate, a bigger, broader debate about, you know, public policy and what's better for the state going forward.
Finally, in the last couple of minutes that we have, you know, we've been talking about the agenda of the legislature. I want to talk about someone else's agenda, Governor Snyder's. He's giving the State of the State address next Wednesday. How do you think that's going to affect what's going on, you know, in the legislature? What will the State of the State really mean for things going forward? Saul?
Well, look, I think people are very excited about moving forward. And I think that, as Debbie mentioned, Michigan is coming back. The country is slowly coming back. We've got a lot of challenges. We have a lot of potentially very big pitfalls ahead of us. And so, you know, if we can set aside, this is the challenge again, we have to set aside the battle of right to work. If we can, and divide it into kind of two fronts, if you have a right to work battle on one side and everything else on the other side, I think we're going to have a very positive agenda and move Michigan forward in a very productive way. If right to work becomes the issue, and if it hampers everything else we're going to do, and it is decided for political reasons to be the driving force of the debate for the next 2 years, it's going to be a very tough 2 years for us politically because they won't get a whole lot of things done. So, you know, the governor has to put forward a positive agenda, respecting the views of minority, understanding the challenges and the frustrations that the Democrats currently hold with respect to right to work and other issues. And the Democrats have to say, yes, we're, you know, not very happy with right to work, but we're willing to look at some of the other things that might make sense. If we can come to that, which is not an easy thing, in fact, it's going to be a very, very difficult thing, then we can move forward. If politics takes over and dominates the process, you know, it will be a very tough 2 years.
I think that Democrats have to be smart. Anybody who thinks that right to work is not going to be front and center as a core value issue to Democrats is wrong. Democrats have to be smart in really getting people energized, and it will be an important part of the public policy discussion for the next 2 years, both in deciding an approach on whether there's reconsideration of the issue or how it is voted on by the people, and electing people that they believe better represent how people in Michigan feel. At the same time, they've got to make sure, I think you're going to see Democrats drive issues that they do care about in terms of manufacturing, how to continue to keep us being economically competitive on other major issues that they care about. Are there places of common ground that people can work together? They've got to try to find it. Are relationships stressed? Very real. The governor's election is going to dominate the next 2 years. And everybody's got to try to make that a healthy discussion and one that's not negative, and that we do not set Michigan back in its economic recovery as we have very real and valid discussions on public policy and the direction the state's going.
And we'll leave it there. Debbie Dingell, president of D2 Strategies and the Democratic National Committee woman. Saul Anuzis, former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. Thanks to you both.
Great to
Thank
be with you.
You.
Thank you.
Detroit's top lawyer has lost her job. Mayor Dave Bing was able to garner enough votes from the city council to remove Corporation Counsel Crystal Crittenden yesterday. Crittenden seemed to just sort of continually challenge Mayor Bing, as well as the state's consent agreement with the city. Critics of Crittenden say she was a thorn in the progress of trying to get the city's dire finances in order. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here to flesh all of this out and what it means for the city going forward. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And some pretty big news.
Yeah, it was. I was a little surprised when I got an email saying that they were going to have a press conference to discuss the status of Crystal Crittenden, which, of course, you knew at the time as means that they had fired her. Look, this has been something that they've been trying to get done for some period of time. The mayor wanted to do it. People in Lansing had said to me and to others privately that they thought the biggest impediment to moving ahead with restructuring the city was not the city council or the mayor, it was the lawyer. And you talk to a lot of lawyers on the outside, and they were kind of befuddled as to who exactly their client was, her client was. And I think clearly the council president, Charles Pugh, said in our pages that he thinks that the mayor ought to have the right to appoint his own city attorney, and I think a lot of people would probably agree with that. But this is not going to be the end of this, I'm sure.
No, and for someone who might be in West Michigan or something like that, they might just sort of think, okay, the city's attorney, so what? But, I mean, she was able to leverage just sort of this insane amount of power, or at least be able to leverage in order to sort of stop things in their tracks.
Well, she was, and I think you have to walk this back a little bit. Her power, the greater power that she had, I should say, really kind of came out of the charter revision of the city, the revision of the city charter.
Mm-hmm.
And that revision was powered in part by the effect or the impact of the Kwame Kilpatrick years.
Exactly.
So something, to some extent, you see the legacy of Kwame Kilpatrick's wielding of power in the fact that she had more power vested in her, and council had more power vested in it than under previous mayors. So this is kind of a legacy of Kilpatrick, and the charter revision is now being exposed to being having been something that wasn't very well thought out and clearly was not built for emergency kinds of situations. The other thing I think you have to say here is that my guess is that the mayor went to some key members of council and said, look, we are getting down to a period here where the governor is going to be forced to act. Our numbers are getting worse, and he's going to have to do something, and he's not going to sit idly by and not do anything. So we have got to move forward here, and one of our biggest impediments to moving forward is our city attorney, who I think a lot of people think is doing the bidding of a minority on council.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what I want to go to next, which is this sort of other news that's, you know, combined with this, that, you know, just this week, Mayor Bing says, you know, the state review team could make recommendations to Governor Snyder as early as this week, he's saying possibly Friday, you know, on whether a takeover of the city's finances could happen. You know, Snyder appointed the team last month. So I guess the question is, will it make Governor Snyder say, okay, here are some actual things that Bing is doing to you know, try to move forward, or is it just sort of a shot in the dark on Bing's part?
Well, I think it's possible. And I don't mean to hedge, but I think it's possible that it could slow things down. But remember, the governor has been burned multiple times in when he's tried to move with half measures, and he's tried to avoid the major confrontation of an emergency manager. And I suspect that his patience, I think I know his space is wearing thin. That said, would you think that if they take these actions and they're starting to move ahead that, you know, on Friday he's going to appoint an emergency manager? I don't think that's going to happen. Again, we've talked about this before on your show, but, you know, on Sunday, the 4,000 journalists are going to descend on Detroit from all around the world. You know, there's a distinct possibility that this thing could come to a head next week. I kind of doubt it. I think they're going to want to kick the can down the road just a little bit, give council more time. I think that's also a show of good faith on the part of the state. I've also talked with people at the state and reported that, you know, this is not as critical as a day-by-day kind of thing. I mean, they can skate this thing along for weeks or maybe a month here or there. So it's not something that has to be done within a day or two of a review team coming back with a report.
Right. We've seen folks in Detroit able to sort of kick the can down the road before.
But I think that can is going a lot shorter distances.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going in increments of like 2 inches at this stage of the game.
Well, let's let's talk a little bit then, you know, about the politics of this sort of coming out of Lansing this week, on top of this news of Bing saying, hey, a report could come out, you know, as soon as Friday. There were some names, actually, names being floated around, people who could be named as the city's EM. Freeman Hendricks on the list, former deputy mayor of the city. He also ran against Kwame Kilpatrick. So these names floating, I mean, how do you see it? Is this more just sort of the Snyder administration kind of putting out that storyline, hey, this could happen? Or, you know, are they actually looking at these people as possibilities?
I think they might be, but I would be very surprised if the governor were to appoint somebody into a position like that that is a prominent political figure. I really don't think that's likely to happen. Number one, that person, if they had any political aspirations, I think you could declare them over at that point. I think you'd be much more likely to find somebody who's a financial technician, somebody who's done restructuring, somebody that might be from a restructuring firm as a possibility. Now, there are local firms, and my indication and my understanding is the expectation is whoever this person would be would come from, you know, our orbit here. They wouldn't be brought in from New York or California or something like that.
So, like you mentioned, we have the auto show beginning next week. Next Wednesday, the governor's State of the State address. What are you going to be watching for? What should we be watching for?
Clearly, the Detroit situation and what the timeline is on that. You know, you point out the governor is giving a state of state next week. Do you really think he wants to appoint an emergency manager, do something like that in the middle of that? I don't think so. And yeah, the auto show going on. I think the auto show in general is going to be good for Detroit, particularly, and for the industry generally. But there are a lot of clouds out there. Europe, rest of world is not good. The United States is, given what we've seen going on in Washington, is going to be a little shaky here in the first quarter until we get some direction. So it's going to be a little bit of wait and see. But I think the general trends are very positive.
Yeah, and in terms of Detroit's finances, what are you going to be watching for?
Well, first off, we're going to want to see if they come back with a recommendation. I think you can assume that the review team comes back and says the situation is worse than it was before. And I think everybody has been telegraphing that, from the governor to the treasurer to the mayor to everybody. I think we know that's going to happen. Now the question is going to be what the governor is going to do in terms of options. Now, remember, with the new emergency manager law, that empowers localities to choose, essentially pick their poison. That may be a step here that we're kind of forgetting.
Right. This.
That, okay. You've got a clear emergency here. Yeah. Here's your four options.
Right. The four options. Yeah.
And number five, meaning no choice, is not an option.
Right. Daniel Howes, business columnist for Detroit News. We of course will talk to you in the future. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
News reports say Michigan's wine industry is doing really well, and it seems like we can't quite hear enough about the really popular and cool new openings of microbreweries across the state. But let's take a minute to talk about a different part of the booze you might consume, a part that doesn't even contain alcohol. That would be ice. Robin Cleveland is a bartender in Ann Arbor, and he recently wrote a piece about the importance of the ice that we add to our drinks. And Robin, I gotta tell you, ice hadn't even really crossed my mind, but you say it's a really important part of making a really good, decent cocktail.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people don't really think about it, but ice can actually make up about 25% of your drink once it's melted in there. And think about the cleanness of our ice that we're getting from the tap. We really want to start thinking about using something that's a high-quality product.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about making your own ice. I mean, it sounds like it can't then just be as simple as, you know, throwing some tap water into something that generally looks like ice cube-shaped plastic and then tossing it into the freezer.
Yeah, we start with distilled water, and that's the biggest key, is to have it really pure. And, you know, we found that the purer the ice, the slower it melts, and it's the impurities that actually can make it melt faster. So for certain drinks, we do want some melting for mixing cocktails and things of that nature, where we actually want dilution. But suppose we're pouring a glass of really nice scotch or bourbon. In that instance, we're really looking for more of a chill than the dilution. So that's where a really nice cube of ice comes into play.
Okay, so what else? Is there anything about how long you leave it in? Do you want to over-freeze it? Is that even possible?
Well, the biggest thing to pushing impurities out of it is actually what's called directional freezing. So what we'll do is we figured out a way through our various trial and error and reading what other people have done before us, and we actually put our blocks into like a cooler that you would take to maybe a sporting event or something like that, and we leave the top open. That way it will freeze from one end to the other, and all the impurities will be pushed to one end instead of around the whole cube. It's really neat.
And so do your customers actually notice a difference in the ice? Has anyone actually said anything to you about, a drink tasting different or not?
In general, people are really wowed by the size of the cubes more than the flavor, but I think the fact that they're not tasting anything is proof alone that we're successful.
Okay, well, what about the size now that you mention it?
We usually do them about two inch square cubes, roughly, just big enough to fit right inside the glass with no extra room to wiggle around.
Oh.
Found that the more surface area there is, the less crevices and things like that the alcohol can get into. And alcohol itself is actually pretty hot, so it will melt the ice cube. So the less the alcohol touches, the slower it's going
to
melt.
So I'm trying to imagine this in, I don't know, a whiskey glass or something like that. It must only be able to fit like one ice cube.
One big cube. That's it.
Okay. And Robin, finally, are you someone that drinks your drinks on the rocks?
In general, I like to do one cube. And I try my whiskey first without any ice. And that's the best way to get the full flavor that they intended it to be. And then a little bit of water, which you'll get from the ice, will really open up the drink and make it marvelous.
Robin Cleveland, bartender in Ann Arbor, recently wrote a piece about how important ice is in a good cocktail. Robin, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. We will be right back after a quick break. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cindy Canty. A quick bit of news to talk about. A divided panel of the Michigan Court of Appeals has upheld extending health benefits to the live-in partners of state employees. The court majority said the policy does not violate Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage and civil unions because it treats same-sex and heterosexual live-in partners the same way. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette could appeal the decision to the state Supreme Court. We turn now to the topic of safety, whether it's on the streets, in our homes, or in our neighborhoods. The message from the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police is that police departments are shrinking, and we're all paying a price whether we realize it or not. Executive Director Robert Stevenson spoke with Cindy earlier this week. Stevenson is a former police chief for the city of Livonia with over 37 years of police experience.
In 2001, we see that Michigan local police agencies had about 22,488 police officers, and today that's down to 18,849. That's a 16% drop. Pretty significant, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen a big drop in the amount of police officers that are available to respond to calls for service.
And this is across the state?
Yes, it is. And it's hit some departments more than others, but I would venture to say every police department in the state is smaller today than it was 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
And why is this?
Well, it's a combination of factors. It's a reduction in revenue sharing to the city from the state, which has reduced funding. But probably the biggest hit that departments have experienced is because of the drastically reduced property tax values. And the majority of most municipal agencies' funding comes from their local taxes. So what they found is that cities have been drastically reduced in the amount of tax revenue they've got, and correspondingly they have less money, and that comes across eventually to police departments. Because cities, unlike the state and unlike the federal government, are prohibited by the Constitution to run a deficit. So cities have to have a balanced budget. And when there's less money coming in, there has to be reductions, and typically public safety, police and fire, take up more than 50% of a city's total revenues or expenditures during the year. So therefore, they're hit the hardest.
what would be an answer around that? Because certainly if I'm running a city and I'm looking at declining property tax values and foreclosures and less money coming in, I have to cut. What would be a way around this, or what would be a solution to this?
Unfortunately, the only real solution to this, especially short term, would be a millage, a special millage to make up for the revenue funding that the cities have lost. Projections are that it may take up to 20 years for the property values and the corresponding tax increases to fully recover in the state of Michigan. So therefore, we see no short-term relief in sight. As an example, if tomorrow somehow all of our property tax, all of our property's values doubled, mm-hmm. because of the Headley and Proposition A, the most that you could raise tax revenues would be 5% or the rate of inflation. And the rate of inflation is running way less than 5%. So where your taxes can go down 50% in 1 year, they're only allowed to go back up 5%. So even if you had a 5% increase, it would take 10 years to get that 50% back. So cities, really, the only real answer to this is a millage increase, or to find ways to do your policing at a cheaper rate.
And how would that work? What are some ideas there?
one thing which departments have explored is the concept of regionalization or combining of services. So take an example of a city like Livonia, where at one point in time we had a 20-member special weapons and tactics team or emergency response team. What we've done because of the cuts in our budget is we could no longer afford to have our own team, so we joined a regionalized team. So now we have 7 members of our department that are in consortium with another group of cities, where everybody throws in a little bit of manpower, and then you make up a specialized unit. Combined dispatch centers, what we're seeing is that cities are looking to combine their dispatch centers. So rather than each city have their own dispatch center, 6 or 7 or 8 more departments will get together and just have one dispatch center. And there's a corresponding reduction in the manpower costs, which, again, saves the city money.
And actually, as you talk about these streamlining ideas, Robert, with the idea of sharing expensive equipment or having a collective emergency response team, is that all bad?
No, it's not all bad. It's a way to do it more efficiently. But what we find is that typically cities want to be in control of their own police departments. And this goes to the residents. Residents want their police department. They want a police department that's fully responsible just to them. So when we see that we have these combined dispatch centers, there's usually a fair amount of opposition from the city residents, because they want to be in control of their own police department and all of their own resources. But no, it's not necessarily a bad thing, and maybe that these tough economic times are allowing cities to do things that they would never be able to do before and try different initiatives that they wouldn't have been able to do before.
If you're just joining us, we are stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty, talking with the executive director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police, Robert Stevenson, about the fact that Michigan police ranks are down 16% over the past decade. Robert, what price are we paying in terms of public safety and fighting crime for this erosion in police forces? What services have been lost?
Well, one thing that's recently been in the news and noted around the state is that there's been a rather significant reduction in drunk driving arrests and traffic enforcement. Because what happens is that we will always channel what resources we've got to answer emergency runs and high-priority runs. When we have less police officers that are out on the roadways, what happens is the officers have a higher percentage of obligated time, meaning they're going from call to service to call to service. Therefore, they have less time for just that random patrol that you would see. If you live in a subdivision where you used to see a police officer just drive through just on random patrol periodically, you don't see as much of that anymore. The police officers are not available because they're just handling call for service. So there's less traffic enforcement, and contrary to public opinion, we don't write tickets to raise money. We write tickets because there is a correspondence between the amount of traffic enforcement that a police department has and the accident rate. So we no longer can go to high traffic intersections and concentrate on what causes crashes there. We're not on routine patrol looking for the drunk driver that's out there. Specialized undercover cyber units that would maybe work inside mall parking lots looking for people that are breaking into cars or looking to rob a place of business. Those units have been totally eliminated. Units have been eliminated. School resource officers have been eliminated. The primary function of a police department will always be its patrol, uniform patrol, and a lot of these cuts and the reduction of services that we've seen are in the ancillary units that we've got. Less detectives. Therefore, let's say that your vehicle was broken into, where before we may have had the luxury or the ability to come out and actually fingerprint that vehicle to investigate it. We just don't have a detective that's available for that because that detective's working on a house burglary. So they're, you know, we have to prioritize. And so that detective isn't available for some of the, you know, the quality of issue or quality of life type crimes that they could traditionally do.
What impact has all of this had on the officers?
It's difficult when you're busy from the time you get into the car to the time you leave. And when I say busy, that all of your time is obligated. It's frustrating not to be able to go to the schools. It's frustrating not to be able to stop by the businesses, to make those relationships that police officers a lot of times will have with local businesses that are out there and people within the community. And it's frustrating, you know, knowing that we can do a better job, that we can protect our citizenry better if we had more resources that are available. And it's also very frustrating as an administrator of a police department because you know that there's things that you can do that will make your community safer, but you just don't have the resources to do it. And there's nothing that can really be done about it absent a millage or an increase in funding.
And over this contraction, this 16% contraction in the ranks of Michigan police over the 10 years, what impact has that had on crime rates? Can you track that?
Well, crime has started to trend back up again. And so we have seen that crime is up. And I do think that there's a correlation between the amount of officers that are out there, and especially the officers that can concentrate on a lot of the more serious crime and the career criminals that are out there. Because you could have one person that starts to commit some burglaries, and they might commit 10 or 15 burglaries before they're finally and hopefully would be apprehended, whereas before you might have been able to get that person after they did two or three.
What future do you think exists, Robert, for public safety? And by that I mean where one person covers police and fire duties. Is that a solution at all to this?
Well, that it's interesting that you point that out because that is one thing that a lot of cities are starting to look at is the combination of police and fire services, and we have seen more and more interest in that, and we are seeing departments that trend that way. I think that there is some ability for cost savings there. In modern America, the amount of fires that we have, building structural fires, have come down. So we've seen major cities that have a predominantly volunteer fire department. Even the city of Troy is a predominantly volunteer fire department.
I was actually going to point that out because I used to live in Troy, and I do remember that.
And they have an excellent fire rating.
Yeah.
But part of that is that the codes, the building codes that we have now, you know, we don't have the large fires like we used to have. That's a very good point, Cindy.
Well, I kind of wonder, do police officers kind of say, well, I don't think that firefighter is going to make a very good police officer, and are the firefighters saying, I don't think that cop will make a very good firefighter?
Well, interestingly enough, there's a lot more resistance to that from the fire side than it is necessarily from the police side.
Well, it's kind of interesting, and I'm hearing that. I say that because I am the daughter of he's passed away now, but my father was a fire captain, and I do remember those sentiments being expressed around the kitchen table.
Well, as we were saying before, we're going to see if things continue like they will, and there's nothing to say that they won't economically, we're going to see that things that traditionally would never have been contemplated will come about. And part of it is that there are no other options. And where each department and each city may love to have their own individual fire department and their individual police department, it just may turn out that that's a luxury and that you can no longer do that.
Robert, we've seen, for example, in the city of Pontiac, where the county, Oakland County, has stepped in and they have taken over local policing, and also the fire department has gone away in Pontiac. But how is it working when you see the county step in and take over for a municipality? Is that a successful marriage?
It can be. It's a case-by-case situation. And police chiefs are sometimes looking over their shoulder now, wondering, is this going to happen? Is the funding going to go away? And that can be a problem. But there's many places that it's worked out, and it's worked out successfully. It's worked out good for the citizens in their public safety, and it's also worked out well for the economics of it. But again, a lot of that gets down to each individual community. I think all things being equal, would prefer to have local control over their police departments. But it all depends on how that comes in. If it's a perceived that the agency that's coming in is a hostile takeover, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, that can be a real world problem that's there. So these things have to be studied very carefully, and they have to make sure that everybody's on board. What we've seen that makes it more successful is that when the sheriffs come in, they absorb or hire a lot of the personnel that's already there that's policing that community. And that's what I believe they did in Pontiac. A lot of the Pontiac officers actually joined the Oakland County Sheriff's Department.
So they started wearing the brown sheriff's uniforms.
They did, and my understanding is that it's worked out well. And, I mean, that was a community that was having tremendous economic problems at the time.
Yeah.
And they were worried how they're going to get paid.
What are your biggest concerns or worries about the future for police work in Michigan?
Well, my biggest concern still is the funding issue. Mm-hmm. And we've got something, a thunderstorm that's on the horizon, and that's the elimination of the personal property tax. If you were following what happened in the lame duck session, they quickly passed an elimination of the personal property tax.
Right.
And that has huge ramifications on some of the cities. The city that I used to come from is looking at potentially losing $7 million a year in their funding. Some other police departments, and I know Midland was highly funded from Dow Chemical, they could potentially lose up to 70% of their city's revenue, I understand, which would basically put their police department out of business. So, and we've seen this all around the state, that some cities are going to be tremendously impacted by this elimination of the personal property tax. So we're watching very closely to see, you know, what type of replacement revenue is going to be there for these cities. So that is probably the most immediate concern that I see for many police departments around the state.
And what can citizens, the people who are listening to our conversation right now, what can they take away from all of this, and what should they do?
Well, if I were a local citizen and I wasn't aware of what was going on, I would look and contact their police department or look at their city budget and see what has happened in their police department. And most police chiefs are more than willing to explain to their citizenry what's been going on. We want them to be informed. So consequently, if I were them, I would find out what's happened and see where the cuts have been. And then I would look and make a conscious effort and say, you know, do I want to fund my police department? And if we do, maybe we need to look at a special millage, because typically the contribution from each citizen is not a whole lot of money, you know, $50 a year or more to keep their police staffing levels up. And I think a lot of it is just the people aren't aware of what's been happening to their department.
What it does sound like is your hope is that people would be open to a millage, not do a knee-jerk reaction. They don't need the money.
Correct. Now, just before I left the city of Livonia a year and a half ago, we had a successful millage campaign. And one of the things which was pointed out to the residents was it would cost them each a little less than $100 a year in the additional property tax. But the typical homeowner's property tax reduction because of the falling property values was already close to $1,000 or more. So they were actually looking for just a small percentage back. And sometimes it's just a conscious decision that you have to make, is that I want to feel safe, and it's worth it to pay a little bit to have that.
And what's your biggest concern for the future safety of the public in Michigan?
Well, I think it's the same concerns that I've expressed earlier, is that if we continue to see this reduction in police officers, we are going to pay a consequence for that. Trust me, the police serve a function when they're out there on the road. Even when it appears to the local citizen that they may not be doing anything, they're out there and they're sending a message to the people that are inside the city and that are driving by, is that we are here, we are protecting, we are watching, and we're ready to respond to keep our people safe. And the less we have there, the less we can send that message.
Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside, Robert.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you and your audience.
Robert Stevenson's the Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police.
And here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. On Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside was directed and produced today by Mercedes Mejia. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, and Cameron Stewart. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark. Thanks so much for listening.